And at 25 minutes after the hour, we're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie, an Anglican pastor, and lives in Ashburn, Virginia, with his church in Fairfax. And just a hoot and holler from Washington, D.C. David, he's even busier than you are. You know that? He's got a bicycle ministry. He's got a church to pastor. He attends the homeless shelter. What else do you do, Robbie? Oh, you're the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. Nice job on the newsletter this week.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah.
Today, the Sermon on the Mount, and I've long had questions about that. I'll start off with a question, probably an easy one. I believe this was just before his presentation at the synagogue in Nazareth, and Jesus was early in his ministry still when this happened. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I mean, and it also will depend on, you know, there's two accounts.
That's true.
And I'll muddy the waters even further. Is the Lucan account the same as the Matthew account? Because you have the Sermon on the Plain in Luke 6. You have the Sermon on the Mount.
Mm-hmm. In Luke, it mentions he came to a flat space. The thing that makes me question my assumption, though, is he was drawing crowds from Judea and Jerusalem and Tyre and Sidon. He was a known quantity. He was attracting hordes of people for this occasion. So this may have been a month or two since he came up from the Jordan River and the wedding at Cana, and then he started visiting synagogues and going through all the towns. He had quite a following, so maybe he was well established in his ministry by this time.
Yeah, the chronology is difficult to get your head around, especially since the different gospel writers will kind of shuffle some of the chronology of this.
Well, I think Luke tends to be more chronological than say Matthew, who kind of skips around. I think that's a safe assumption. But this is chapter 6 in Luke, so it's, you know, Jesus has been around for a while.
Exactly, and then the other piece of that is, you know, Jesus has just called his disciples in Luke 6 before this, and so this, you almost get it really early in his ministry with the calling of the disciples and then going right into the Sermon on the Plain.
Something else of interest to me is that both Matthew and Luke have accounts of the Lord's Prayer. And in Matthew, it seems like he had called his disciples on the mountainside that day and was talking to them about prayer, and then gave him the disciples' prayer, or the Lord's Prayer, as most of us know it. Yet in Luke, it doesn't appear that was the occasion.
Yeah, I mean, Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount is Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And then the Lord's Prayer, or the disciples' prayer, as we've often called it, because Jesus is teaching his disciples to pray like this. And we've talked about the Lord's Prayer being John 17, where Jesus is actually doing the praying to the Father. We can see what his prayer looks like.
I would agree, yeah.
Yeah, so right in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 6. So Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And then Luke, the Lucan account, is light on that, leaving that piece.
Well, it seems to me that, and I just to bone up for our conversation today, I've scanned both Luke 6 and I'm working my way through Matthew. Seems like they're talking about the same event, really. They may have changed the location, but that who knows how many years transpired before Matthew wrote this down. And Luke may well have, you know, he starts off by saying he wants an organized account, so he's probably interviewed other disciples and people who were witnesses to all these events. So I tend to trust his chronology. But it seems to me this was a training exercise intended for the disciples to begin with. But there were all these people around, and how could you ignore that?
Yeah, and for me, I, you know, you get little textual hints about the crowd that's around the scenario as well. So if you look at what comes before in Luke's gospel account, you get Tyre and Sidon mentioned as people are coming from Tyre and Sidon.
Which is quite a distance. I'm assuming this was done in the north, in around Galilee someplace. Do we know where this happened?
probably north and west of Capernaum. There's a grassy plain there, and that would have been a prime location.
Chorazin, it could have been.
Yeah, and if it's true that the Sermon on the Mount is a different account, then he would have had to been up in a higher place.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the again, there's clues there. We're not just, you know, guessing. There's a mention of the crowd. It says in Luke's gospel account in chapter 6, verse 17, it says he came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people. And then we get to know where these people come from in verse 17. It says from Judea, Jerusalem, and the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon. So this is the Mediterranean seaports of Tyre and Sidon, right on the Mediterranean Sea, and the tribal land of Asher, that little strip there, who came and to be healed of all their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And then when you go to the Matthew account, it's different. You don't get the people from Tyre and Sidon mentioned in that Matthew 5, 1 says, seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. So again, this is a mountain, and Lucan's account is the plain. So,
and the reason I ask is because I'm interested, and many people are, in all the context. Mm-hmm. The important thing is what he said, but the next important thing is why he picked then and there to do it. And we try to determine that by, and the geography is part of that, and the history is part of that, all the other aspects of contextual understanding. But I guess what's really important is what he talked about.
Yeah, and so if you look at the Matthew account and the crowds and who these people are, what is interesting is in the Lucan account and in the Matthew account, Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, both of these are happening in Luke and in Matthew's gospel in chapter 4. And it's so those chapters are actually lining up with the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. And for Matthew, Matthew is trying to paint a picture of Jesus as the greater Moses. And so Matthew was written around, Luke was written around 70, and then Matthew would have been anywhere from, I've heard, 65 to even later to 85. So Matthew has been thought to be the first gospel, which is why it shows up first in the New Testament, or the Second Testament.
Now, I do know historically that the book of Matthew gained great fame and attention over a large part of the world. In fact, I understand that when Portuguese sailors arrived in India on the West Coast, they found whole churches that were based upon the book of Matthew. So somehow it found its way probably to Babylon and down the trade route into India. That's astounding. His book gained wide distribution, and I don't see that same story applying to the other Gospels.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's because there were more drafts of it or not, but we've got Mark's Gospel being the earliest. There have been found earlier manuscripts, mm-hmm. So we're placing the writing of Mark's Gospel around 55, where Matthew, say, around 65.
That Luke would make sense, because the historical speculation was that Matthew left Jerusalem just before the crisis with Rome and went east to Babylon and then down, and may have brought his own writings and influence and person down to India. And we don't know. That's just tradition, but that would explain it. And then that also would kind of verify the timing you mentioned of the authorship of his book.
Absolutely. And then to your point, in Matthew 4, in verse 12, we get kind of the context about the Nazareth piece. It says, now when he had heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew into Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum. So we get Jesus making his home in Capernaum in Matthew 4. And then he lived, and this is the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, the crossroads, mm-hmm. the east-west trade route, the north-south trade route.
where Isaiah, I believe, had predicted the Messiah would appear.
So that quote is contextually, it's the bullseye of Isaiah. It says, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people dwelling in darkness have seen a great light. For those dwelling in the region of the shadow of death, on them a light has dawned. And from that time, Jesus began to preach, saying, repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Now, that's a huge line, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand, because this plays out in the economy, and I'll use that word intentionally, the economy of the kingdom that's presented in the Sermon on the Mount, or the Sermon on the Plain in Luke's account. And for me, I'll just show my cards. I'm believing that Jesus is preaching the same or similar message on two different accounts. And so while the teaching is similar, I believe the Lucan account is indeed a Sermon on the Plain, and the Matthew account is indeed a Sermon on the Mount. And I'm just taking the text at face value, where we get the geographical, or in this case, I would say the topographical context. Could we dissect modes of context so particular that we don't just look at the geographical context, where we are on the map, but where we are above or below sea level? Are we on a mountain or are we on a plain? And so I believe that the topographical context is telling us that these are two different accounts or two different teachings.
And yet the subject matter is the same, and that may be in part because Luke consulted Matthew, either his writing or talked to Matthew about this event, and got the facts straight from Matthew, because he was not an eyewitness himself. Matthew would have been.
Yeah. And so let's also look at the guest list. I mean, let's just follow the chronology as we're in Matthew 4, in verse 18, Jesus calls his disciples. He calls the first disciples. This is, again, Matthew 4:18. But then when you get over to the Lucan account, Jesus calls his disciples in chapter 6, verses 12, and names them. So the disciples are named in Luke 6:12. And then here in Matthew 4:18, we get the fishermen, they're named, and James and John, the brothers, the sons of thunder, but the rest of the disciples are not named in Matthew. So it's interesting. And then Matthew gives us the guest list. So this is Matthew 4, verses 23 through 25, in juxtaposition to the guest list that we just read earlier in Luke, which includes Tyre and Sidon. Here we get the Galilee, and now we've got the Decapolis, which isn't mentioned in Luke. So it says, and he went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. And they brought to him all who were sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, and those oppressed by demons. Those are the same needs mentioned in Luke, by the way. And those having seizures and paralytics, and he healed them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis and from Jerusalem and Judea and beyond the Jordan. So there's your guest list in Matthew's gospel.
Hmm. Also, as mentioned in Luke, the man with a withered right hand being healed in the synagogue. And to me, that's such an interesting contextual story. It's included in Matthew as well, although, and this is just a minor point for now, because I don't want to get into the right hand thing, but Matthew did not mention his right hand, just said his hand. And when the folks at The Chosen produced this particular event, they actually showed Jesus manipulating the man's wrist, which would not have happened. That's an important part of this whole story. But it is mentioned both in Matthew and Luke, so there are parallels, but there are differences as well. And that's okay, because each of the Gospels is a different point of view, a different author, and a different purpose for the writing, at least somewhat
absolutely.
Different.
Yeah. Absolutely. And would you know offhand, do you know, pardon the pun, which chapter that is in Matthew? Because I know it's in Luke 6.
Okay. Well, I'm told it's in Matthew. I'd have to search for it and see. I think, because I don't see it here in Matthew. Maybe I'm wrong. But it's somewhere else.
Matthew 12, 9 through 13.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so it comes much later.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that clue could be that the Sermon on the Mount happens much earlier in Matthew's gospel, and then it's linked much later, potentially, in Luke's gospel,
mm-hmm.
in that the man with the withered hand. And again, the chronology is a little bit off. So in Luke, it's chapter 6, and in Matthew, that account, that parallel account, mm-hmm. is Matthew 12.
And it follows the grain field incident, where the disciples were hungry, began to pluck the heads of grain to eat, and then the Pharisees saw it and said, oh, they're working on the Sabbath. That's a whole different story. I can understand why Matthew might have put it in a different place, because it's a bit of a distraction. But Luke leads with it, so it's part of the time.
Yeah, yeah, and it's linked too. I mean, this hand is linked to the hand washing and all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's fascinating, and just for let's just unpack what we're doing.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, let's unpack what we're doing. So when we study the Bible in context, it's important that we read the text that comes before our focal text and the text that comes after it, because that adds a deeper depth of meaning and understanding. And so we're trying to read the text in its context. So we're trying to put the verse in the paragraph in the chapter in the book, and then the book alongside of the other books that are like it. So in this case, we've got a harmony of the synoptic gospels. We're looking at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and that's the synoptic gospels. And in this case, we're focusing on Matthew and Luke, and we want to note the similarities and the differences. And in the case with the man with the withered hand, what we're doing is we're trying to figure out, where does this show up in Luke? Where does it show up in Matthew? And are they the same? Are they different, and why? And that's important. The other thing is, we're looking at that guest list. Who are these crowds that are gathering? Are they the same crowd? Well, according to the guest list, they're not. And where are we on the map? Topographically speaking, in Matthew, we're up on a mountain. In Luke, we're in a plain. So we're beginning to make deductions of the text that these are probably different accounts. Now, I've looked ahead. I cheated a little bit. I've looked at some of the commentary, and the commentary is divided. There are some that believe that these are the same accounts told differently, and there are some commentaries and scholars that believe that these are two different accounts. And so I'm not rigid on that one way or the other, but where I'm falling is I believe that they're separate accounts.
I don't think the difference is, I hate to use the term game changer. It's so used. Yeah. It's way too many commercials these days, but it doesn't change my thinking about Jesus or about where he ministered or what he had to say. But it is interesting. It's worth talking about and looking at, but don't let it distract you.
Indeed. And one of the things that we can do to have a deeper understanding of the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain is read both accounts and read them in context. So at Preserving Bible Times, we have a book called The Rest of Those Stories. And in the rest of the story, in chapter 3, Doug Greenwald picks apart and dives deep into the Matthew account of the Beatitudes. And he talks about, what does it mean to be blessed? And that word is being used, blessed or spiritually happy. Kenneth Bailey in Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes says that this is not labeling. It's not saying, hey, be this and then you'll have that. It's actually pointing out people who are already in the state of having inherited that, because they're living in poverty, or they're living in a state of being merciful, or they're living in a state of persecution. And so it's more of a highlight saying, look at these happy people. because they have an inheritance, an inheritance. In the case of Luke's gospel, you've got a juxtaposition of four blessings and then four woes. And Luke kind of takes apart the Beatitudes in that way. And in that, Matthew says, say verse 3 of chapter 5, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who are mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. So you get a posture, poor in spirit, and then you get a blessing, the kingdom of heaven. You get a posture, I'm in a state of mourning, and then you get the blessing, comfort. And so that pattern repeats itself. And Kenneth Bailey points that out in Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. But in Luke's account, Jesus says, blessed are those who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. It's similar, but then he juxtaposes it with a negative. So let's just take that in 20 verses 24 of Luke chapter 6. In 24, it says, woe to you who are rich. So that's the opposite of poverty. So the Sermon on the Plain juxtaposes positive and negatives, blessings and woes. So here, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Well, that sounds like Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
But in verse 24, the opposite. Woe to you who are rich, for you've received your consolation. In other words, hey, you're rich, you've got your reward. And then we'll do it again with 21. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied, is juxtaposed with 25, which says, woe to you who are full now, for you're going to be hungry. So again, there's this opposites that are true. If logic tells us if it's true one way, then the opposite has to be true. So if I'm hungry, I'll be satisfied. Well, the opposite of that is if I'm full, I'll be hungry. And so Jesus is juxtaposing these things verse by verse times four, verses 20 through 22 and then 24 through 26. He says, woe to you who laugh now, for you'll mourn and weep, is juxtaposed with blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. And so be content with where you are, because the opposite can certainly come about. Might be another way we could think about that blessing.
I'm trying to see if there's, I don't want to distract, but it's something called inverted parallels come into play when a rabbi speaks or teaches, and Jesus used the teaching technique over and over, and it's usually where let's say there are five statements in a parable. Statement one would have to do in parallel with statement five. Statement two would have to do in parallel with statement four. And then statement three would be the essence of the whole parable. It would be the primary meaning. It would be like, if this was a joke, that's where the punchline would be. Here in the West, we expect the punchline at the end, and everybody laughs. But these folks were accustomed to listening to teaching from rabbis and looking for that center point, which was really the emphasis of the whole story. I'm not sure I can see that in here. And if you let yourself think about that too much, it'll drive you crazy, because we don't think that way. But this was an oral culture, and they were
right.
They listened in a certain way. And in Luke's account, there are eight statements, four Beatitudes, four. I'm looking for another statement in there, you know,
right.
Middle statement.
With Luke's account, you mean?
Yeah.
So you're right to point it out, and the other issue that you have there is the linguistic form. So if you've got a poetic structure in Greek or Hebrew, and then you translate it to the English language, you lose the form.
Mm-hmm.
The word count's not the same. The breaks in the line aren't the same because of translation. So now we're talking about the linguistic context.
That's right. Matthew would have, maybe this is an assumption, would have been written in Hebrew. Is that a truism?
Well,
and we have a translation probably into Greek and then to Hebrew, or then to English, but Luke would have gone from Greek directly to English.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Matthew is Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his Jewish name is Levi. Did he write it in Hebrew? I mean,
that's another one the scholars debate. So
yeah, but we know it's been translated, so we lose the poetic form. Is you know the main point I was making, but in Matthew's gospel, you've got another purpose of writing, and Doug brings this up in chapter 3, and I highly recommend the rest of the story. We've got it up on our website for sale under eBooks. You can find it on Amazon as well on Kindle. But chapter 3. Doug points out the paradigms and the worldviews that Jesus is basically assaulting with the Beatitudes as a response to the worldview of the day. So what are those worldviews? Committed Judaism, normal, I don't know whatever normal is, but then you've got the Essenes, you've got the Zealots who are wanting to kill Romans. And so when Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, it's an affront to the zealots.
Hmm.
And so each of these things, the pure in heart is an affront to the Essenes who valued purity. And then you've got the Pharisees and the Sadducees that the Sadducees don't believe in a resurrection. So blessed are those who mourn, you will be comforted. There's some allusions there to resurrection. So Jesus is systematically confronting the worldviews of the day, systematically coming at these things and highlighting them and really kind of, to use that word juxtapose again, juxtaposing it or contrasting it would be another way to say it. So in the first century Palestine, there were multiple worldviews within Judaism, including those of the Sadducees, Zealots, Essenes, Pharisees, ordinary observant Jews, Hellenistic Jews, or the Greek-influenced Jews. Each was unknowingly being held captive to a worldview or a paradigm.
And here's an unnerving parallel to the present time, because the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Essenes, and a little bit later, the Zealots, came into being as political parties.
Hmm. Yeah.
And later, you know, evolved into or developed into the leadership in Jerusalem, although there were other Pharisees with other stripes, other colors, other characteristics in other parts of Israel. But these people you're talking about that Jesus is confronting here have 100 years of history behind them as political parties. And that's what got in the way of the faith, of the Hebrew faith. The politics intervened. How like the present times?
Yeah. So we got the religious right. So is that okay? And the answer would be maybe.
Mm-hmm.
<You know? laughs> Sometimes.
Thanks for that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we think that, oh man. Yeah. History repeats itself big time, doesn't it?
It does.
Again, you get the liberal branch of Christianity that's all for justice and all for mercy at the expense of truth. And then you've got the religious right that says, you know, we need to take over the political realm, where certainly that is a biblical worldview that we must insert our religious convictions, our Christian worldview, biblical truth into everything we do,
mm-hmm.
including politics. But then the zealots would say, you know, let's overthrow the government completely and separate ourselves. So, yeah, I mean, this is the Beatitudes. This is the context for the Beatitudes. So when Jesus shows up, he's trying to present a biblical worldview. When I say biblical, the First Testament, by the way, I think that's a new way I may refer to the Old and the New Testament, the First Testament and the Second Testament.
There you
go. I think that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Because just because it's old doesn't mean it's outdated. Because in Matthew's gospel, Jesus says, and I think it's in Luke too, he says, I didn't come to abolish the law, I came to fulfill it. So what is the law? It's the books of Moses. So he's trying to get them to rightly apply a kingdom worldview. This is why I said that one-liner about ushering in the kingdom economy is so important, because Jesus's kingdom is not of this world. So if we expect that we're going to overlay our Christianity over the politic, and then that politic's going to save us because we've Christianized it, then we've left the kingdom. The kingdom is greater than a political party. And this is what Jesus is getting at. It's greater than a religious denomination or stream.
Oh, it is.
That's what Jesus is getting at.
Pastor Robbie, again, the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. And if you'd like to take a look at the rest of the story, you can link to Preserving Bible Times from our website, brokenroadradio.com, or just go to preservingbibletimes.org. Click on eBooks there and scroll down to it. And there's an explanation there, and you can purchase it. It's not an expensive thing. So take a look. It's an amazing writing from Doug Greenwald, who was the founder of Preserving Bible Times a long time ago. Robbie, have a terrific week. Again, thank you for what you bring to us. We look forward to Thursdays. Can I call you brilliant?
Far from it, but a joy, privilege, and a pleasure to be with you, Jim and David, on The Broken Road.
Pastor Robbie, we'll see you in a week or so. Bye-bye.
God bless.